session number 25054, Reel 2.
Derek Plummer, Reel 2. So, how did you get on with the townspeople of Dartmouth? Was there any friction between
them? None at all. It was a very quiet place, and it was completely Navy. They were used to the Navy all the time. There was no violence, no thuggery, no football crowds, nothing like that at all.
Were you considered sort of gentlemen, as it were?
I hope so.
You were going through your sort of daily timetable, so you were doing schoolroom lessons up to lunchtime.
Yes. And then most afternoons we would do, again, a lot of signals, but this time were Morse and flags, actually a semaphore, and of course gunnery, which was a complete and utter waste of time because the equipment there was archaic. They had a four-inch gun, which they kept on saying, well, sorry, this is the best we can do. You won't find this in any ship. Well, what the hell were we being taught about? And Knocker White, the chief gunner's mate, was not the best of teachers, as I said before. But we occupied, I suppose, some amount of time doing that. And, of course, knots and splices and things like that. And that went on till tea time in the evening. We could always go down to the river if there was time and grab a boat and sail down there. I had no idea about naval terminology and things like that. I knew how to sail because I got my own little boat, but we were part of our contingency there were people from Pangbourne, cadets from Pangbourne. I think there were four of them. They were pretty good blokes. And I think I learned the proper sailing from the people from Pangbourne. I used to go down to the river and they taught me a lot.
So you seem to cope with this pressure of learning a lot of things fairly quickly, with some enthusiasm.
Yes.
Could everybody do that? Did everybody cope?
I think so. Perhaps the answer was in the final. We were only 3 months, and we had exams at the end. No exams at all, no tests or anything during the 3 months. But the end exams did have some bearing on our future promotion. You could get seniority. The better you did, you got additional seniority, too, which was rather complicated. I never understood that. But if you did well as a cadet in your exams, you could get seniority. You then became a midshipman, all of the same seniority, and you had to do two years, whether you were good or bad as a midshipman. You had to do 2 years. At the end of your 2 years, you became an acting sub-lieutenant, and you went ashore for sub-lieutenant's courses. More exams, more seniority, and finally the seniority begins to affect you, because as a sub-lieutenant, a confirmed sub-lieutenant with a commission at last, you do 2 years. You're all made a sub-lieutenant on the same day, let's say any 20 of you on the same day, and you've got 2 years to do, but if you've done well in your exams and you've got 6 or 7 months promotion, you only do 2 years less than 6 or 7 months. And I got, I don't know, about, I think I got about 7 or 8 months seniority. So I only did, as a full commissioned sub-lieutenant, I think I only did a year and a half of my two. Then I was promoted to lieutenant.
Did you do any physical training at Dartmouth? I mean, keep fit or...
Yes, my God. Plenty of that, and I can't. I think that was I should have said that was another one of the morning things before breakfast at the gym, and we had to take ourselves, falling in one to come up the front taking the gym, which is good for you.
Yeah.
Learn how to shout at people.
Mm. And any sports?
Yes, we played rugger. It was too late for cricket. September, November. I was in the rugger team, and we used to go. We played at Blundell's. There was a school that moved down to the west during the war. There was a school down at... Yes, we played. And other naval colleges. We went down to play in Manamede and in Portsmouth. Great fun, travelling around. I was in the rugger team, yes. I loved it.
And were you there at Dartmouth through the Christmas?
No. It's all...
You'd done by then?
We'd finished, thank God. Yeah. Quite early in December. We were sent on leave, and we were told that if we had any particular friends, we'd made friends during our very short time at Dartmouth, we could ask to be appointed with them. And there were four of us who had gone on very well. Dick Slaughter again, the man who had the uncle who had the big hotel. Um, and Paynton, that's where the hotel was. Dick Slaughter from the Falkland Islands, Pat Frost from Stonyhurst, Roman Catholic, and a boy from Wellington, the son of a colonel, P.G. Warren, Philip Warren. I survived the war, Dick survived the war, and as far as I know, he's still flying an aircraft between two farms in Africa, one at Nakuru and one at Subukia. And Pat was killed in a submarine, and something happened to P.G. Warren, and he didn't finish the war. Whether he was thrown out, whether he committed suicide, whether he was, I just don't know. I completely lost touch with him. So those are the four. We were all appointed to a cruiser.
So you wanted to be appointed together, and you were.
Yeah, we were appointed, which is nice of the lordships. So a cruiser called Suffolk, HMS Suffolk, which was a heavy cruiser, one of the county class, but she had been very badly damaged in Norway, the Norwegian campaign, and the repairs still weren't ready. So we were all sent off, us four and other ones who we didn't know were coming to Suffolk with us. We were sent to big ships, bigger ships. I was sent to King George V, a brand new battleship. But I didn't ever get there.
Oh, right.
I had a monumental car crash on 3 days before Christmas on 1940.
Really?
I'm afraid I did. My brother was in the army. He was in the back of the car. I was driving. My mother was my passenger. She went through the windscreen. And I went through the roof, literally. And it was nighttime in a Dorset lane or road. It wasn't a lane. And when the people came out, no traffic in those days at all. Apparently, they took my mother and my brother off to Poole General. My brother then went back to his unit. He'd only broken his nose. My mother was taken into a hospital there, kept in hospital. Luckily, she had a very rich sister who enabled her to have go up to London, to the London Clinic, and be operated on, three operations over a period of months, with a man called Archibald Mackinder, who became knighted. And of course this was before the Battle of Britain, so he was and he did three operations on her, and my goodness, it was quite extraordinary how beautiful work it was.
And on her face, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes. And I went through the roof, and they thought I was dead, so they left me literally hanging out at the top of this metal roof, sort of high cross thing around it. By the time the ambulance got to Poole, which was about 6-7 miles away, someone realized I was alive, and they phoned up the hospital and said, send the ambulance back when you're ready. We'll try and get this bloke out. And, of course, it's easy to go through a roof. It's very difficult to get you back again. And I woke up in 1941, about 11 days after the crash, and there was a vicar next, and there was a daub the size of my bed, a gap, and the other side was a vicar. And he told me my mother was okay. He told me what had happened. I remember nothing of very, very little of what he said, so he wrote it all down, and he gave me, he was out the next day. He was discharged. He wrote a most wonderful letter, which I kept until some so-and-so stole it from me. Someone in the 51st Highland Division of the Army, of course not Navy, wouldn't do a thing like that. I went to a private nursing home with my mother. Then she went to her sister's and up to Canterbury. And eventually I managed to persuade the Admiralty I was fit enough to go back to sea. And when I finally joined Suffolk, she'd come out of the Clyde, and was sitting out of Glasgow. She was sitting at the tail of the bank off at Gourock or Greenock, and I joined her there, and I was horrified to find that I was a senior midshipman.
Right, so that was in what?
That was must 41? Have been about, that was 41, yes.
Yes, what time of year? Is it a few months ago?
February, end of February, I think. But can I tell you a little about Suffolk? Because it's important in that it had an effect on all of us, because she was required to go, I think it was to Stavanger, and shell. She had large guns, 8-inch guns, 8 8-inch guns, just the perfect thing for firing shells into Norway. and she was going to go and fire shells and try and damage an airfield. I think that's what was going to happen. The Navy never let anyone down. They turned up on time over in Norway in the right position, and the air cover, which had been promised, didn't materialize. The Luftwaffe soon realized that here was a very large ship ready to be bombed because there was no one helping them. And the bombing started quite early in the morning, about 8 o'clock, I think, let's say 8 or 8.30, and she was bombed almost continuously for 6.5 hours. Now, it seems difficult to believe it, but most of it was high-level bombing, and it proved later on that high-level bombing is an absolute disaster. You can dodge the bombs as they come down, almost a complete waste of time. And when later on, after 2 or 3 hours of bombing like that, there was a pause, and then the new blokes came on, and they were, amongst them were the Stukas, the dive bombers. And about 3 minutes later, a bomb had gone down X turret. That's the, you've got four big turrets, two forward, A and B, and two down aft, X and Y, Y on the quarterdeck. And it went down X turret, went right through, causing almost a lot of damage. I don't know what happened. It caused fires. It spread into magazines and shell rooms. There was a violent explosion, and the stern was blown off. A lot killed, and she limped back to Scarpa without any steering, but she could steer by main engines. You've still got propeller shafts and propellers, so varying the speed of that, you can steer. And the captain very skillfully got her back to Scarpa, and she was then taken down to the Clyde and refitted, a new stern built on. And whilst they were doing that, the midshipmen had to be, they were under training, they were sent to all the other ships. And so she had no midshipmen on board at all when she was finished. Additionally, they had thought fit at that stage, very sensibly, their lordships, to fit this new thing called RDF, which is now known as radar, radio direction finding. And so when she came out, she had an extraordinary thing looking like an iron bedstead on her mast. And beyond that, you weren't allowed to think what it was. If you asked, you were sort of locked up, so you didn't even think. It was so secret. So when I joined the ship, there were Suffolk. All my friends were there, the other three. But we knew nothing about RDF or radar, and we had no midshipmen. Like all big ships then, you had three officers' messes. For lieutenants and above, you have the wardroom. And on the same deck, there's a nice social thing here, you have the gun room for midshipmen and sub-lieutenants. And a deck down, you have the warrant officers' mess. And I was in Suffolk just on 2 years, and I never once went in the warrant officer's mess, and I never once saw a warrant officer in the gunroom. It's a terrible thing, isn't it? But they did away with that in 1948.
So when you joined Suffolk then, your rank would be what?
Oh, midshipman. Yes.
And what was it like actually joining, walking up that gangplank? Because I presume you didn't know all... Didn't know anything. The naval routines.
No, absolutely nothing. Nothing at all.
Customs, aren't
there? Absolutely nothing. And it was a foggy, miserable day, and...
Where did you join her?
She was at the tail of the bank. It's off Greenock in the Clyde. And it was early morning, very early, and there was a thick fog. And the motorboat that picked me up took me over all my baggage. And just between us, from where I was joining and the ship itself, Suffolk, there was a sunken vessel, funnels, mast, a warship. She'd been sunk 2 days before. It was a French light cruiser. She'd been bombed by the Luftwaffe and sunk. And of course, she was sitting on the bottom, but a lot of us still above water. And the doctors from Suffolk went out in motorboats because they couldn't get out of there. Many of them were trapped below decks, and their scuttles, or portholes, as people will call them, weren't big enough to get through. And so they were told to get their arms out, and the doctors jabbed them or killed, you know, put in a fatal dose. And let them, yes, it was awful. And she was there, for months and months, I think. Yeah.
So that was the only thing they could do.
That was the only thing they could do. There wasn't time, she was sinking. Yeah. Yes. And they just drowned. Well, they were put down by the doctors. But the point I was trying to make was that we had no midshipmen other than these new boys. Every other midshipman in the world has joined a ship where they're senior midshipmen, people who've been to sea for 3, 4, 6, 12, 20 months. We had none of that. And to be the senior midshipman, because of my exam results, I soon learned that Senior Mitchelman really was only there to be responsible for the behaviour of the others, which is at times pretty disastrous. You soon learn to take all the kicks that we got. But it was a pity. We never really learnt very much. We had to learn it all ourselves. We couldn't ask one of the midshipmen, you know, you've been here a long time, what happens next? We had to find out for ourselves.
Yeah. So as you arrived, some of the other midshipmen had already been there
a
month or two then.
Yes, that's right.
Right, so what did they tell you? Did they give you any hints as to... Well, the day was going to proceed, as it were.
Yes, I had to ask them and find out. We had the midshipmen were, before I told you, Pat Frost, P.G. Warren, myself, Dick Slaughter, that was four. In addition, we had two more from our term of cadets, two Indians. One was a Muslim called Mohammed Fahim, and one was a Hindu called Rao, R-A-O. And Rao was about as bad as Holy Mo or Muhammad Fahim was good. He was an absolute brilliant midshipman, very, very good officer indeed. Ra was an absolute so-and-so. So there's six. We had two darts, senior darts. One was a bloke called Todd. I don't know his Christian name. We always called him Tilly. He was such a Nancy. And the other dart was a bloke called Cedric Wake Walker. Now, Suffolk was in the first cruiser squadron, and the flagship of the cruise squadron was Admiral Wake Walker, his father, who was a pity. And Wake Walker was in Norfolk, the same class of cruiser. And then we had six Polish midshipmen, and I can't work that out how many I've got now. I think that's 14. And then we had two more, paymaster midshipman, again a Dartmouth bloke, and I can't remember his name, except it was Charles, and he was, I think, in love with me. So you can tell.
There was a lot
of that in the Navy, wasn't there? Well, they always say so. I never personally experienced, but he followed me around like a dog. It was awful. And everything I said, he laughed at or smiled, and oh, God, I couldn't get rid of it. But he was a paymaster, so he wasn't the same. I was an executive. There was a vast difference. But we did have one senior midshipman. But he was a paymaster, a bloke called Tony Bland, who had been at sea now for over a year. He was the captain's secretary. He was not moved out of the ship when she was refitted. But he was a paymaster. You couldn't ask him what you do at two watches or how. He doesn't know anything. And he didn't want to know us. We were far too junior. But he was there.
And the captain was?
Captain was Captain Ellis, R.M. Ellis, Robert Merrick Ellis. And please don't ask me what I thought of him.
Oh, I was just going to.
He was one of the worst-tempered men, bar one, I ever met in my life. He was a brilliant captain, and his ship was probably the most efficient ship in the fleet. But it was an efficiency achieved by fear. And all his wrath was vent on officers, never ratings. He was the most appalling man. He was very, very tall. He was a specialist. He was in the Fleet Air Arm, and he was a pilot, not a pilot, he was a navigator. At his age and the rank, of course, he'd take him out of the Fleet Air Arm and in general service. It's unbelievable the way he behaved at times. I was one...
Was he a bully or...
Yes, bully. Yeah, and everybody was frightened of him, including his commander. Mm. Terrified.
Looking back now, now that you're older and wiser, was that a sort of, because he felt not up to the job, or was he, why?
No, I think he knew he was up to the job. He was just in his making. His stock phrase was, when he was shouting out, that war is total. And I took that to mean that nothing is it. No excuses are warrant your behaviour. Doesn't matter what you've done. If you've done it incorrectly, the wrong way, which is wrong because war is total. You must never do anything wrong. He was a fiend. One night, at sea, we thought we were going to be in touch with the enemy. It was dark. And I had never been on the bridge at sea at all. So my first, and it was my last time. And later on I'll explain why. But Mohammed Fahim was ill, and I was told to go and do his night on his bridge, in the bridge. I think it was the middle watch. When I got to the bridge, it was pitch dark, and there must have been lookouts. There was the officer, the watch, the captain, the navigator, all looking out of the windows in the front. It was an enclosed bridge, not an open bridge. They had windows in the front. You open up, and the captain was dead silence. And I was told, I say, sit quiet. He's listening. The captain was sort of leaning out of the front, listening for the enemy. And I patiently stationed myself at the back of the bridge. All bridges are steel decked. But in the middle of the steel deck, there's an island which is 18, 20 inches high, made of wood. And it's a wooden platform, and it's called the compass platform. And the compass platform is raised like that and has the two compasses, a gyro compass and a magnetic compass. And the raised part is so that you get a better chance of taking a bearing over the ship's side, sort of thing. You're liable to walk into the compass platform in the dark, and it'll hit you right in the middle of the shins. I stood myself right at the back thinking, this is the best place where all the telephones are. Thank God when the telephone rang, a little red light, and it only went once, that was quite enough for me, and it was the engine room. And there was an engine room commander was speaking. I said, Bridge, Midshipman Plummer speaking. So he said, oh, Plummer, commander, whatever his name was. He said, will you ask the captain if I can have permission to shut down one boiler? Shut down one boiler means you're going to reduce speed. The enemy, what we thought was with us, just the one thing that wouldn't work. So I said, and I shall never forget it, I said, hang on one moment, sir. And there was a scream from the boat. Hang on! Who the bloody hell said hang on? I said, Plummer, sir, it would be only monkeys and midshipmen hang on. He said, I remember it just as if it was saying monkeys and midshipmen hang on. So I said, engine commander wants permission to shut down one boiler. With that, he turned, huge man, silhouetted against what little light there was in the window, pitch dark, and he came forward. I thought, God, this is me. I'm going to die. And he hit the compass platform, walked straight into it. It crashed down. Now he came to it really fast because I was the best. And I sort of put my hand out to help him. He brushed me aside, picked up the phone, and he talked to a commander, it was just awful. And he said to him, what the hell do you think you're doing? He said, if you want to behave like a bloody child, I'll have you on the bridge on your knees praying like a bloody child. We've got signalmen, lookouts, messengers, all on the bridge, hearing this from the captain to one of his commanders. It was inexcusable. Absolutely. That was what he was like.
Did anything ever happen to him because of his behaviour?
No, he did very well in the Bismarck thing. I mean, he was entirely responsible for the early parts of the episode with the Bismarck. He's a brilliant man. Right. But he never got to Admiral. I think people knew what he was like, really. But he just couldn't help him, I think. Yeah.
But he produced the results, so...
He produced results, definitely.
Yeah. So tell me about your first trip out of port, then, on the Suffolk.
Yes, I do, actually. Apart from just going down the Clyde to do speed trials and things like that, eventually we were ready to go after about a week, I think. We went up to Scarpa.
And what's Scarpa flow like? One hears the names often, but I mean...
What's it like?
What did it look like?
Golly, that's a difficult question. Well, to begin with, to approach it, you come... through the Pentland Firth. So in clear visibility, you've got land on either side. You've got, to the south of you, you've got Scotland, right along to Cape Roth, and then, you know, where the Queen Mum's, the Castle of May. And then finally, there's a little place up there called Thurso, but that's 3 miles inland. But there is a port to Thurso, and it's called Scrabster. But you can't see any of that. You can just see the coastline. And to the north of you, the other side of this passage where you're going up, you've got the Orkneys. And it's just bare land. It's flat. I don't know what the highest part. I suppose the old man of Hoy is the tallest bit of rock there. I don't know how much, 100 feet or so. But most of it's very flat indeed.
Were there many ships there?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You see, it's really is an inland waterway surrounded by islands. It's not... perfect. So if the water between two islands is only 2 or 3 feet, they don't have to do much about that. No ship's going to come in there. But one or two places the water is deep, and there they either blocked, put ships or something across to stop it, and eventually they made it as watertight, ship-tight as possible, so no foreign ship, so U-boat or anything, could get in. There were two entrances. One was called Flotter, and the other was called or something else. And there you went through a boom, a gate, as it was, and two vessels, and they pull the net aside as you go through, and then they close it when you get. What the hell are those two called? Doesn't matter. And of course, the Germans got through. You remember the what's his name? I can't even remember the name of the German young officer who got through, and he sank the Royal Oak there with loss of 500, 600, 700 men, right in the middle of the flow. The flow itself is huge. You can't see from one end to the other, usually because the visibility is so bad. Tucked away somewhere to the east is the capital. The rest of it, you never see anyone, a few sheep. But the destroyers, after Suffolk, I was in destroyers, and I stayed in destroyers, and that's a separate part of the flow, and you're divided, thank God, from the main. Of course, you don't have millions of admirals looking at you all the time. That was called flotter. The main flow was the flow. The destroyers area was called the flotter. It was called flotter, because that was the name of one of the islands. They've all got wonderful names.
So that was your first journey, was up to
that? That was up, yes, yeah.
It must have been quite exciting.
It was very exciting, and I was longing to see what it was like, but... I don't think I'd ever want to go up again. We were so often in there, and we very, very seldom came south of Scarpa. Mm. But it was home.
Yeah. So the days went on Suffolk, and you got more used to your
Yes,
cities,
I do,
imagine.
Yes.
How did you have much contact with ratings?
Oh, yes, my God, yes.
Right, tell me about that, what sort of job you were actually doing.
Well, I think... The best thing to tell you is that you have a 2-year syllabus as a midshipman, and most of that syllabus can only be done in harbour, because you do a time on with motorboats, for instance. You run motorboats day and night. That was marvellous. You do time on the quarterdeck, strutting around with a telescope under your arm and helping the officer of the watch run the routine of the ship from the quarterdeck. You had a short spell in the engine room, a short spell in the boiler room, a short spell with the navigator doing chart corrections in the chart house. You did a bit of everything, really, even on the flag deck with signals. So all this had to be done to get used to the general ship, not just your specialisation, the rest of the ship. And, of course, the midshipman had to fill in a wretched journal every day, which was very difficult indeed. Also, of course, an awful lot of navigation, star sights, sun sights, moon sights, all the rest of it. You can't really do that in harbour. Of course, you can cheat so easily. You can look at the chart and see where you are, say this. But these things can really only be done in harbour. Once we went to sea, we were no longer under training. We were on the watch and quarter bill. We had a job to do in all three states of readiness. At sea, in my time, you had three states of readiness. The easy one was when you left harbour and they were not going to be in touch with the enemy, and it's called cruising stations. And you're in three watches, so you're 4 hours on, 8 hours off, very comfortable, red, white and blue watches. If the enemy is near you, submarines, aircraft, anything else, the normal way we steamed in Suffolk was at defence stations. So you go from cruising to defence, and defence means half the ship's come and it's closed up. Half the weapons are there, you're now ready to face the enemy. And the two watches are port and starboard. And then finally you go to the highest state of readiness, action stations. You're not in watches at all. The whole ship's coming, it's close up. So you go from three watches, two watches, to no watches at all. And each midshipman is a member of the ship's company now, definitely. And you can't change them around like you can change from boats to quarterdeck in harbour, but otherwise you'd always have 14 or 16 weak links in the organisation, people who are just being in there a week or two, and another month they're going to change. So I had three stations to keep in those three watches, and I kept them the whole time I was there. Two of them were one and the same thing, but it was called the ADP. I was officer in charge of the ADP, which stood for Air Defence Position. This was a platform deck above the bridge, the main bridge, and open deck, freezing cold, absolutely always snowing, raining, absolutely dreadful. And I had up there 16 lookouts.
I'm going to stop you just there. Derek Plummer, end of reel 2.